Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving deep into, well, the very essence of life itself. How organisms get energy, how they change it, how they use it. Our mission is to pull out the most important insights from two really fascinating lectures by Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman. He's going to be our guide through the basics of energy, the rules of thermodynamics, and then the amazing world of enzymes inside our cells. Expect some surprises, maybe some practical takeaways too, about what's happening inside us right now. Okay, let's unpack this. So Dr. Hoffman kicks things off with biochemical pathways. He describes them as like these daisy chain reactions connected in series.
Right, where the product of one step becomes the reactant for the very next one.
Yeah, exactly. So you go from a starting point to a final product through all these little steps in between, these intermediates.
And he points out that huge processes, things like cellular respiration, photosynthesis, they're just specific examples of these pathways.
It's how life organizes its chemistry, basically.
And that organization really ties into what Dr. Hoffman identifies as a fundamental trait of life, this constant processing of energy. Life is energy processing in a way. And energy itself, he defines it simply as the capacity to do work.
The capacity to do work, okay. And Dr. Hoffman breaks energy down into two main types, right? Potential and kinetic.
Potential is the stored energy, the energy something could use.
Like the chemical energy in your lunch. Or his example of someone standing on a high diving board that's stored gravitational energy.
Exactly. And then kinetic energy is the energy of motion. It's energy being used now.
So the person climbing the stairs to the diving board, that's kinetic. And then jumping off is kinetic too.
Right. And the key thing Dr. Hoffman stresses is how easily they swap places.
Potential becomes kinetic when you jump.
And kinetic becomes potential when you climb back up. It's this constant back and forth.
Which leads us straight into thermodynamics, the study of these energy changes, especially heat.
Yeah, and he sets up this framework, a system that's whatever we're looking at, like our body, or even just a cup of water.
And the surroundings.
Everything else, the rest of the universe. It helps isolate what we're studying.
Makes sense. So with that system surroundings idea, we get to the laws of thermodynamics. Dr. Hoffman focuses on the first two for biology.
Yep. The first law is the big one, conservation of energy. You can't create it. You can't destroy it.
Only change its form or move it around.
Precisely. He says it can be transferred, like a cue ball hitting other balls, or transformed, like sunlight warming you up, light energy becoming heat energy.
So the total amount of energy in the universe just stays the same.
Stays constant. It just puts on different hats, you could say.
Okay, but then the second law sounds a bit less optimistic. Entropy.
Huh, yes, the second law. Dr. Hoffman explains that in any energy transfer or transformation, the total entropy of the universe increases.
And entropy is disorder, randomness.
Basically, yeah. The universe as a whole is constantly getting more disordered, kind of winding down.
What does that actually mean for, like, a cell or us?
Well, a critical consequence, Dr. Hoffman points out, is that some energy always gets lost as heat in every single transaction. Nothing is 100% efficient.
Ah, okay. So energy conversions aren't perfect.
Never. He uses the example of a car engine. Most of the gasoline's energy is just wasted as heat, not pushing the car forward.
Or his running cat example, the cat uses food energy to move, but a lot of that just becomes body heat.
Exactly. That inefficiency, that heat loss, is a direct result of the second law.
Okay, here's where Dr. Hoffman introduces something called free energy or Gibbs free energy. Gee, this sounds important.
It is. He defines it as the potential energy in a system that's actually available to do work. The useful part, maybe.
But he says we're usually more interested in the change in free energy, delta G.
Right. G calculated is the final free energy minus the initial free energy. And the sign of that delta G tells us a lot.
Okay, so what does it tell us?
Well, if G is negative, Dr. Hoffman explains, it means the process is spontaneous. It'll happen on its own. Because the system is moving to a more stable state, lower free energy, higher entropy. Think about falling off that diving board or diffusion or big molecule breaking down. These things naturally want to happen. They release energy.
And if AG is positive,
then it's non-spontaneous. It will never happen on its own. Dr. Hoffman says you'd have to force that to happen by putting energy in.
Okay, spontaneous versus non-spontaneous. That seems like a core concept.
Absolutely. And Dr. Hoffman then links this to two other pairs of terms that basically describe the same thing from different angles.
Right. So first, spontaneous, non-spontaneous tells us if it happens. What's next?
Next is exergonic versus endergonic. This describes what happens to the energy.
Okay.
Exergonic reactions release energy. They have a negative G, so they're spontaneous. Endergonic reactions require energy input, positive G, non-spontaneous.
Got it. Release versus require. and the third pair.
That relates to metabolism. Catabolic versus anabolic.
Breaking down versus building up.
Exactly. Catabolic reactions break down complex molecules into simpler ones. They release energy, so they're exergonic and spontaneous.
Like digestion.
Perfect example. And anabolic reactions build complex molecules from simpler ones. They require energy, so they're endergonic and non-spontaneous. Like building proteins.
So Dr. Hoffman's point is these sets of words, spontaneous, non-spontaneous, exergonic, syndergonic, catabolic, anabolic, they're all describing the same fundamental split.
Precisely. A reaction is either one type across the board, spontaneous, exergonic, catabolic, or the other, non-spontaneous, endergonic, anabolic. It clarifies the whole energy flow.
That really does help simplify it. And he uses this great analogy, right? The hydroelectric dam.
Yes, to explain open versus closed thermodynamic systems and how organisms fit in.
So a closed system is like a dam where the water just sits, no inflow?
Right. Dr. Hoffman explains that eventually the water levels equalize, the turbines stop spinning, the light goes out. That's equilibrium, which for an organism, he says, is death.
Because life isn't about equilibrium.
Exactly. Life resists equilibrium. Dr. Hoffman stresses that all organisms, in order to be alive, have to be open thermodynamic systems.
Meaning
they constantly exchange both matter and energy with their surroundings, like a dam with water constantly flowing in and out. If that flow stops, the organism dies.
Okay, so life is an open system, constantly taking stuff in and putting stuff out.
But there's another layer, Dr. Hoffman adds. Organisms don't just have one big energy drop, like one giant waterfall.
They don't burn fuel in one step, as he puts it.
No. Instead, life uses a multi-step open hydroelectric system. Think of a series of smaller dams or locks in a canal.
Releasing energy bit by bit.
Yes. Multiple small gradients, releasing a little bit of energy at a time via biochemical pathways. That controlled step-by-step release is crucial. It's manageable energy.
And that manageable energy brings us to ATP, doesn't it?
The star player. Adenosine triphosphate.
Dr. Hoffman calls it the most important energetic middleman. The energy currency of the cell.
A perfect description. He breaks down its structure, a nucleotide base, adenine, a sugar, ribose, and the key part, three phosphate groups.
Right, triphosphate. And there's ADP with two phosphates and AMP with one.
Mm-hmm. And the core idea is that cells don't directly burn food, like glucose, for energy for most tasks.
They use the energy from breaking down food to do what?
To build ATP. They stick that third phosphate onto ADP, storing energy in that bond.
So ATP is like the charged battery.
Exactly. Then when the cell needs energy for something else like muscle contraction or active transport, it breaks that third phosphate off ATP, turning it back into ADP.
And that releases the stored energy right where it's needed.
Precisely. That's the ATP-ADP cycle Dr. Hoffman details.
Right.
Breaking ATP down hydrolysis or dephosphorylation is exergonic, catabolic, spontaneous. It releases energy.
And building it back up, phosphorylation requires energy.
Requires energy input from catabolizing fuel. It's endergonic, anabolic, non-spontaneous.
Okay, so the cell links these two. The energy-releasing breakdown of food powers the energy-requiring making of ATP.
Yes, and then it goes one step further with energy coupling. This is brilliant.
How does that work?
The cell uses the energy released from breaking ATP, an exergonic process, to drive other reactions that require energy. Endergonic processes.
So it pays for the hard stuff with ATP.
You got it. Dr. Hoffman explains, the cell stays alive by paying for its endergonic processes with the energy that it gets from its exergonic processes, with ATP as the middleman.
Can you give an example? He mentioned one, right?
Yes. The synthesis of glutamine from glutamic acid and ammonia, that reaction has a positive key. It's endergonic. It won't happen on its own.
Needs energy.
Right. So the cell couples this reaction with the hydrolysis of ATP, which has a nice negative cheat. The energy released by breaking ATP is more than enough to power the glutamine synthesis.
So the overall coupled reaction becomes spontaneous.
Becomes exergonic and spontaneous.
Yeah.
The cell effectively uses ATP to force the non-spontaneous reaction to occur.
Wow. It's a constant cycle then, ATP to ADP and back again.
A dynamic balance. And Dr. Hoffman notes that if AMP levels rise the monophosphate form, it's like an emergency signal.
Calling the cell.
Ramp up ATP production. Get cellular respiration going faster to meet the demand. It's a feedback system.
Okay, so we have the energy currency, ATP. But these reactions, even the spontaneous ones, might be too slow on their own, right?
Way too slow for life. Which brings us to Dr. Hoffman's next topic, enzymes.
The cellular accelerators. He calls them biological catalysts.
That's what they are. proteins, mostly, that speed up a chemical reaction, sometimes millions of times faster.
And crucially, they do this without actually being a reactant themselves. They aren't used up.
Right. They're reusable. They just facilitate the reaction.
So how do they actually do that? How do they speed things up?
Dr. Hoffman explains it centers on activation energy, or EF.
Activation energy. That's like the energy needed to get the reaction started.
Kind of. He describes this unstable transition state that reactants have to pass through to become products. Think of it as an energetic bump in the road or a hill you have to climb over.
That hill is the activation energy.
Yes. And Dr. Hoffman states very clearly, all enzymes do is somehow reduce the activation energy. They make the hill shorter.
So it's easier and faster for reactants to get over the hump and become products.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, and this is critical, Dr. Hoffman stresses that no enzyme ever changes the value of BG.
Why not?
Because E is about the difference in energy between the start, reactants, and the end, products. The enzyme only changes the path, the height of the hill between start and end. It doesn't change the starting or ending energy levels themselves.
Okay, that makes sense. They lower the barrier, not the overall drop. And they're specific, right?
Extremely specific. Dr. Hoffman uses the classic lock and key analogy. Each enzyme has a unique active site, a little pocket or groove shaped for its specific substrate, the reactant it binds to.
Which is why we need thousands of different enzymes. Each does one job.
Pretty much. And it's not even a rigid lock and key. He describes induced fit.
What's that?
When the substrate binds, it actually causes the enzyme to change shape slightly, to wrap around the substrate for a tighter fit. Like a firm handshake, he says.
It's like a grab hard handshake. I like that. Forming this temporary enzyme-substrate complex.
And within that complex, the enzyme works its magic, maybe straining bonds in the substrate to help it break apart, or holding two substrates together perfectly to help them join. That's how it lowers eBay.
Amazing. But their shape is key, and shape can be affected by the environment.
Absolutely. Dr. Hoffman explains how factors like temperature and pH are crucial. Enzymes have an optimum temperature.
Where they work best, like body temperature for our enzymes.
Right, around 37, 38 degrees C for most human enzymes. But he contrasts this with enzymes from heat-loving bacteria, maybe optimal at 75 degrees C. Too high or too low temperature can denature the enzyme.
Denature meaning change its shape.
Change its 3D shape, yeah. Which usually destroys its activity because the active site is no longer the right shape.
And pH works similarly.
Same idea. An optimum pH. Dr. Hoffman gives the great example of stomach enzymes like pepsin, working best at a very acidic pH of 2.
While enzymes in the intestine prefer a more neutral pH, around 7 or 8.
Exactly. Change the pH drastically, you change the enzyme shape, and it stops working properly. Shows how conditions matter.
So cells have all these enzymes, but they need to control them, right? Can't have everything running a full blast all the time.
Definitely not. Dr. Hoffman points out it's much more efficient to turn them on and off with some sort of switch than to constantly make new ones and destroy old ones.
Makes sense. How do these switches work? He talks about inhibition.
Right. Two main types. First, competitive inhibition.
Competing for what?
For the active site. An inhibitor molecule, often shaped a bit like the normal substrate, physically blocks the active site. The substrate can't get in.
Ah, like someone parking in your reserve spot.
Good analogy. And Dr. Hoffman mentions this is how many drugs work. They competitively inhibit a specific enzyme.
Okay, what's the other type?
Non-competitive or allosteric regulation. This is maybe even more sophisticated.
Allosteric means other site.
Exactly. The regulator molecule, which could be an inhibitor or an activator, binds to the enzyme somewhere other than the active site, at an allosteric site.
And that binding does what?
It causes a conformational change, a shape change in the whole enzyme, including the active site.
So binding at one spot changes the shape of the important spot.
Yes. If it's an inhibitor, the active site shape changes so the substrate can't bind anymore. If it's an activator, the active site might change to bind the substrate better. Dr. Hoffman says this is exactly like a switch, on or off.
That's a really neat control mechanism, very precise.
And it leads directly to feedback inhibition, a really common and vital control strategy.
How does feedback inhibition work?
Dr. Hoffman explains that often the end product of a whole biochemical pathway acts as an allosteric inhibitor for one of the enzymes early in that same pathway, usually the very first enzyme.
So the thing you finish making goes back and shuts down the production line at the beginning.
Precisely. He uses the example of making the amino acid isoleucine from threonine. When the cell has made enough isoleucine, the excess isoleucine molecules bind to an allosteric site on the first enzyme in the pathway.
Changing its shape.
Changing the active site shape so it can't bind threonine anymore, shutting down the whole pathway temporarily.
Why shut down the first step? Why not later?
Good question. Dr. Hoffman explains it. Nips it in the bud. It prevents the cell from wasting energy and resources making all the intermediate compounds if the final product isn't needed right now.
Super efficient. Prevents buildup.
It's a classic example of negative feedback, which is essential for maintaining homeostasis, keeping the cell's internal environment stable.
Wow. What an incredible journey through energy and enzymes, all thanks to Dr. Hoffman's clear explanations. It really shows this intricate molecular dance that powers everything alive.
It really does. And connecting it all, as Dr. Hoffman helps us do, you see these fundamental rules: energy conservation, entropy, the need for ATP, the role of enzymes, the importance of regulation. They apply everywhere, from the simplest bacteria to us.
It's the universal operating system of life.
You could say that, yeah.
So here's a final thought to leave you with, building on Dr. Hoffman's insights. Thinking about that elegant feedback inhibition, how might understanding these natural regulatory switches inspire us? Could we design better medicines by mimicking these allosteric controls? Or even build more efficient artificial processes by copying these biological feedback loops? What aspect of this energy and enzyme control system stands out most to you? Thanks for joining us on another Deep Dive.